My name is Becky Holt. I am 45 years old. Today is August 19th, 2016. I am in Burlington, Vermont, and I am with my friend, Marty Martinez.
My name is Marty Martinez. I am 70 years old. Today is August 19th, 2016. I am in Burlington, Vermont, and I am a friend of Becky's.
So, Marty, tell me where you were born and where did you grow up?
I was born in Ayer, Massachusetts. And I grew up all over the world because my father joined, was in the Navy and went to the Army and then became an Air Force person a year after I was born.
So tell me, what was it like? What were your parents like?
My father was a Cuban American, and my mother, and as I said, he was an aircraft mechanic who went on from there to become a flight engineer. And my mother was a homemaker and farm girl from Massachusetts, and they met right after World War II.
So when you, did you have any siblings?
I had five other siblings.
And you were, you talked about, we've talked before about growing up in Europe after the war. So
after the war, I don't remember a lot of it, but my father started flying. He got his flight engineer's ribbon and he started flying cargo ships, or cargo planes, and he was flying over to Europe to rebuild Europe after World War II. And we did that until we came back to the United States and we moved to San Antonio, Texas. And then we moved back to Massachusetts, and then we moved back to El Paso, Texas. And, of course, my father still being in the military, we moved every 4 years.
What's your best memory from your childhood with your grandparents?
You asked me that yesterday.
I know.
My best memory was my father being a Latin American. My father would take us to Florida every Christmas we were in the United States. We'd drive from wherever we were, and my grandmother lived in what is now Little Havana off of 8th Street. And she had a giant mango tree in her backyard, and we used to go climb the mango tree and eat as many mangoes as we possibly could. And her poinsettia plants and the smell of Cuban coffee and all my uncles and aunts speaking in Spanish and being in a different culture entirely.
So you told me when we've talked before about your grandfather, your great-grandfather who was in Spain, who was part of a service
organization? My great-grandfather was in Spain, and he was a member of an organization called the Gentlemen of Light. And that is an organization of educated men who take care of the less fortunate. My grandfather also became, once he got his degree, joined the Gentlemen of Light. And he had some well-educated individuals that he knew. And just being around them was very interesting. My grandfather, when he got to the United States, actually worked in Tampa being a reeder in a cigar rolling factory.
What does a reeder do in a cigar rolling factory?
In a cigar rolling factory, they don't have radios, and they didn't have radios back then. So they would have a guy who would sit above all the guys who were rolling cigars, and he would read them like newspapers and books and stories. And cool. It would keep them entertained while they, and he got paid the same amount they did for rolling the cigars.
Very cool. Well, tell me, so service is a big part of your family. That's, you know, with you and your siblings. And I know your mom is an important part of your life. And so tell me about service and your mom and what you learned from your mom.
What I learned from you, you're going to have to be more specific than that.
What did you, what are you proud of with your, you said you had you're most proud of something. So tell me about what you're proud of.
Having accomplished everything that I've set my goals to do so far in life. And it actually affects my attitude, as you know, that I look at each day positively because of it.
So tell me about, you're in a military family. You and your three brothers and your sister all have served in the military.
That is correct.
So tell me a little bit about what you each have done and how you all served.
My father was in the Air Force. For some reason, none of us wanted to go in the Air Force. My brother got drafted, and my older brother, and then he got to go to OCS and got his pilot's license flying a Huey and ended up flying a Cobra in Vietnam. My younger brother is the only one that went in the Air Force. And he died in 83, 2 weeks before Challenger blew up. And his job was to fly out there to keep the fishing trawlers, the Russian fishing trawlers, away from the splashdown zone of our rockets.
Wow.
So I miss him greatly, but he was like the mediator between my older brother and myself.
And you were in the Navy.
I was in the Navy, that is correct.
And you have explained to me that you have the gold wings, which are...
You want me to tell you that?
Well, tell me about what you did in the Navy.
In the Navy, I started off as a crew chief or plane captain, and the United States government was very kind in allowing me to leave basic training at Great Lakes, the coldest I've ever been in my whole life. I still haven't seen a winter here like I have in Great Lakes. And they sent me to the Mediterranean. And we were sitting in the Mediterranean, and this guy named Sadat decided to attack Israel for the 9-day war. And I had not finished high school, so when we left there, when the war was over and we came back off of that tour, some of the pilots came to me and said, you got to finish your education. So I took my GED. Now, I don't know if you know this, but to be an aviator in the military, you have to at least, especially a jet pilot, you have to at least have a college education. So yeah. These guys were like, their majors were all these different subjects.
Yeah.
And I used to ride back seat in an F-4 Phantom. And they used to grill me on questions about Tom Sawyer and math. And I did take the test, and I did pass it. So then
you were a navigator on the F-4, is that right?
I was a radio operator.
Radio operator.
Yeah, they call them a RIO.
So tell me, so you come from a long line of veterans, and came
it
to...
It was kind of a matter-of-fact thing.
Yeah.
That we do. In my family, there wasn't any choice, even during the Vietnam era.
Did you, speaking of Vietnam, did you get any criticism from, let's say, friends or neighbors or people in your community about Vietnam?
People in my community were pretty much all military, so it didn't really, where my parents were. And I pretty much didn't pay any attention to, when I came back, I went back to school. And when I came back from Europe, I went back to school after I finished my GED, and I qualified for flight training, and I went on to do, when I got out of training, I said, I'll go back to Europe, and they said, no, you're not, you're going to Vietnam. So I did almost two tours, but Nixon gave me an early out to go back to college, which I started, and I didn't finish until 40 years later when I was in Vermont.
So when you came to Vermont, you ultimately went back to school. What did you do when you went back to school?
I ran into a mentor who was a psychologist, and he was getting his master's at UVM, and he suggested that I become a psychologist also, and he was a wonderful man. Unfortunately, he's passed away, and I miss him greatly. That was Jason Conway, and he introduced me to a whole bunch of psychologists in this town that were turned out to be good friends over a long period of time. You're asking me about being the first homeless person to graduate from university.
I was only if you wanted to talk about it. So I did. No.
So. Well, ask me.
So you mentioned that you were homeless. So tell me about going to school and how you studied and how you graduated and what that was like.
What I did was I had another veteran who worked for the Organization Committee on Temporary Shelter, COTS, suggest to me that I go back to school because of the fact that I could get grants to go back to school, and I was actually sleeping in my car and dropping in for meals at places. And so I went in and signed up. I had two more years to grow to get my bachelor's, and I went back. I went back to school. For the first 6 months, I lived on the street. When I'd get out of class, I'd go to the Salvation Army and I'd have dinner, and I'd go to the library and study. The next year, COTS came to me and they said, you can live in our facility called the Wilson if you pay rent. Well, I didn't have any income other than the income I was getting from grants from going to school. So I started taking part-time jobs. I cleaned offices. I did just about anything you could think of. I picked up trash alongside the road. I did anything that I was working for two temporary agencies. Odd. And they kept me busy. And then I'd go back to my room and I'd study. And then one day, when I finally got to the point where I was going to graduate, they told me I had to write a graduation thesis. I continued taking courses at Burlington College until I couldn't take any more courses because of the fact that I'd taken every course that they have in psychology. So I ended up transferring to University of Vermont and ended up taking master's courses. And I took them until they finally said to me, you've got to graduate. You've got too many credits.
So you finished.
So I finished. I graduated second in my class.
That's awesome. And so now you work for Champlain Housing Trust and at the Allen House. But at some point, you came to Rita Markley, the head of COTS, with an idea. So tell me about your idea that you came to her with.
Well, in going to school and learning about grants and a little bit that I did learn about it and writing grants, I found out that the VA had a $36 million grant that they wanted to give away to the states and the Eastern Coast to help the homeless vet population. And so since I had been homeless and I knew the people who were running the COTS, or Committee on Temporary Shelter Organization, I went right to the top.
To Rita.
And I said, we've got to do this.
And what was her reaction?
She balked, and once she got up off the floor, she kind of said, do you really think we can? And I said, I think we can beautifully.
So tell me what you did to make it happen.
What I did was she teamed me up with some wonderful ladies who were fantastic for taking my words and being able to solve problems. So we wrote our original grant and we were rejected. And then Rita started coming to me with these monthly sessions. I think it was about 7 years we did that. Mm-hmm. That she would say, what would you do in your house? Well, unfortunately or fortunately, however you're going to look at it, I wrote my degree thesis to graduate out of college on how to run a psychiatric social halfway house.
Well, that worked out well.
So I was studying all the different modes that it could be run in, and I had answers for questions, and we just modified our grant and kept resubmitting, and in the end, we submitted the last one, and we ended up winning $2.6 million grant to build a shelter. And then where to build the shelter was the next question, and I suggested the town I live in, which is Winooski. And because I knew some people in construction, like where I was working when I became homeless, actually jobless, you know, and not knowing anybody in the area. We talked the contractors into building it in 1 year.
And you decided to do this in what year? What had just happened? 2009, perhaps, with the recession, right at the height of the recession. Let's build a building to create housing for formerly homeless veterans and their families.
We will set up a program which they can get their feet on the ground and become successful in what they do. And we can resolve family issues and substance abuse issues and all that as long as they stay within the program. The building was built. It cost $5.8 million to build a building. And a lot of it was contributions through the contractors themselves and individuals the other veterans groups to put this place together. It has turned out to be a very successful program.
So you can see Canal Street from your window, from your house.
I can definitely see it from my house.
So how do you feel about Canal Street when you look at...
Canal Street's still my baby. I am the state homeless chairman for the Veterans of Foreign Wars and the state commander usually gives me direction on what he wants me to do. And I usually go off and do what I want to do. But Canal Street has turned out to be very successful in that we got an 87% graduation rate. And that means getting out solving your problems, your issues, whatever they might be, substance or relationship problems, and being successfully housed. Of the 12 graduates we've had this year.
Oh, this year, yeah. I was going to say, yeah. There's more than that overall.
I know. This year, every one of them is housed and has a job and has a goal in life of either staying clean and sober or working out their relationships. But the plan to operate was actually based on some stuff I came up with through my research, and also a great team of people at the Veterans Administration who came up with some of the other creative ideas to make it work.
So tell me, we were talking earlier about the garden this year at Canal Street.
Oh, the garden.
So you have to tell me about the garden.
Well, the guys at the house, when they want something, they usually come and see me. Because I am on an advisory team that actually helps them accomplish their goals, actually mentoring them. And they came and asked that instead of planting the annual plants around the building every spring and then pulling them up in the fall and then planting them again, they wanted to use the space for a garden. And all I did was talk to the director of
Maggie Miriam, yeah,
and ask her to tell them that we didn't want them to plant plants this spring. Fortunately, a master gardener,
Charlie Narduzzi,
heard about what we were doing. And he came out and had his class build raised beds in these little spaces between the sidewalk and the building. And he actually did a pH value on the soils. And they have tomato plants, pepper plants. And the guys, when he came into it, the St. Michael's College donated like a half an acre for them to have even more space for the garden.
Nice.
So what has happened is the guys are actually the ones that have already graduated in years past have come back and are actually working in the garden with the guys that are currently in the house trying to solve the problems, and they're working together. The other thing, like I was telling you this morning, I have found that the antisocial types have come down and picked a plant, either a pepper plant or tomato plant, and made it their personal baby or project. And we are now donating fruits and vegetables or vegetables to the community food shelf.
That's so cool. Well, there have been 46 veterans who have successfully completed the program at Canal Street since it opened in 2011. Yep. How does that make you feel?
I'm really happy it works. I happen to have the theory that if something's working, don't mess with it. I have a committee of veterans who will help me do just about anything that I need to do to help them. But basically, it's a great program, and it was put together with a lot of thought, not only mine, but like I said, other people's. And therefore, it gives them the flexibility to be able to work on their individual issues, and at the same time, it's a structured thing like the military is. One of the advantages we have is everybody who's in there has been through basic training, so that kind of teaches you that somebody's always going to be in charge, be it your parents or your mother or your grandparents, or somebody's always going to be on the top of the totem pole.
So tell me a little bit about why you, I mean, you're an active volunteer in Veterans Issues with COTS, with others. What inspires you to continue volunteering and helping?
I kind of get sucked into it.
Yeah.
Like Canal Street is my baby. Where a veteran needs something, especially to get, having been a combat veteran, I know how hard it is to adjust back to normal, or what,
yeah.
Normal's a buzzword because it depends on the society what normal is, but you have to make certain adjustments to your personality and yourself to be able to function within a community where you don't have somebody shooting at you and you're not regimented to the point of where you get to make your own choices, and they better be good choices.
Yeah. So you have had, your mom, you said to me once that your mom married your dad, and your Scottish mother left the farm in Massachusetts to marry your father, who was in the military, because she wanted to have an adventure. And
that is true.
So would you say that you have followed in your mother's footsteps, having an adventurous life?
And I would say at 70 years old that I've accomplished, I was talking to my 92-year-old mother the other day. I try to call her at least twice a month. And I told her pretty much everything that I've set my mind to doing. Some people don't like the fact that I, when I decide I'm going to do something, I will take a spoon and move a mountain. But it's just part of my personality. Rita really wasn't that hard to convince, the director of COTS. I mean, once she realized the potential of what we were doing. But there were other naysayers out there who never thought it would happen. But out of that, out of the 2.6 million, we had a shelter in Northfield and one in Rutland who actually applied for the same grant and got rejected. And what we did, since we got the biggest chunk, was we went back and let them read and let them rewrite their grants. And they ended up being successful. So I actually have five shelters throughout the whole state of Vermont that house veterans and are all, Canal Street is only sponsored by COTS and the VA. The other ones are sponsored by church groups, social groups, and communities. So each one of them has a kind of a different tact on how you're treated. If you go to Rutland, you're going to have to be with the brothers and get up and pray every morning before breakfast. Northfield is kind of small. It only has like 12 residents. But the directors I have, I was really, really pleased when I made a suggestion to the Canal Street director, Maggie, that she get together with Kathy, who's the Northfield director, and the two ladies got together and had coffee and decided that since they were doing similar problems, they might as well invite the other three together and they would all sit down. See, so I don't really do anything. I just
connect people.
Yeah.
So tell me, I'm going to backtrack a little bit.
Go ahead.
Tell me a little bit about your mom. I think you're a lot like your mom. You have your mom's blue eyes. But tell me a little bit about your mom and what an influence she's been on your life.
My mom is a very independent, involved lady, and when she decides she's going to do something, she pretty much do it. But you've got to give her credit. And with all the moving around we were doing, and it was five kids, she had to kind of keep everybody herded and in tune there to, like I said, move all over the world. And she's a pretty strong lady. I mean, I'm really blessed to have both of my parents. I think the benevolence part of it comes from my father, though, because there's a long line of it within my family and also with my siblings. So,
tell me about Vermont. Vermont, you said this is the longest you've ever lived anywhere.
Vermont is beautiful. Vermont is gorgeous. As our moderator said earlier, he really likes it here. He might be a transplant. You never know. Personally, I was in Canada and came to New York and then came over to Vermont and fell in love with it and fell in love with the people who live in this state. Vermont people are very giving, at the same time very conservative. There is an old story about a Vermonter plowing his field and a guy breaks down on the side of the road and he says, "Can you help me? Can you tow my car in the town so I can get it fixed?" And the Vermonter says, "Sure, as soon as I finish plowing my field." I mean, Vermont runs on its own pace. Burlington runs on a different pace than Vermont does. But it's kind of the people that I have met throughout Vermont have been wonderful people. I think about a guy I know who has a farm and 36 cows up in Middlesex. Mm-hmm. And he's like a fellow Veterans of Foreign Wars person. And he and his wife come down to our conventions, and they're both in their 90s, and they jitterbug.
They jitterbug?
Yeah. And they're just really down-to-earth people.
Yeah.
So I love Vermont. I probably will end up staying here the rest of my life. And I know a lot of people here.
Yeah.
I kind of have the reputation of walking in and making my presence known.
In your life.
You laugh.
I'm not laughing. I'm laughing with you. Tell me about your happiest day of your life.
Happiest day was when Tricky Dicky got me out of my second tour in Vietnam to go back to college. I was on an aircraft carrier, the USS Ticonderoga, and I got my orders, and within 72 hours, I was standing at LAX in California.
So wait, you were on Ticonderoga? Didn't you tell me your great-great-grandfather came from Scotland and was at Fort Ticonderoga?
There is a rumor to that effect.
Yeah. You know, that's pretty funny. And I can't. And you were born at Fort Devens, right?
Fort Devens was a Army base, yeah, that turned into a Navy base that turned into an Air Force base before, and it's still a National Guard base down in Massachusetts outside of Ayr.
Yeah.
The wonderful thing about that is I called up and I asked them if they had like a little flyer newspaper that might have my birth announcement, and they said, "Sure."
Really?
"Just send us a request. We'll send it to you."
That's cool. So, Marty.
Yeah?
Thank you. Is there anything else I didn't ask that I should have asked?
I hope not.
Well,
thank you, Becky.
Thank you for doing this. And thank you for sharing your stories and talking with me today.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for asking me.